passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me is my colleague Peter Flaherty. Millie is here. She is asleep. She is not happy that she didn't get to go to Omaha. But Peter and I are back from Omaha, and it was quite the exciting tournament overall. The finals were, I don't know, they were exciting, and then they weren't exciting, but overall they were exciting, I guess. And we can now talk about, you know, LSU as the national champion. They won the finals. They beat Florida in three games. That wrapped up on Monday night. And so, yeah, we're going to run through all things that happened in the finals and take a final look here at the 2023 College World Series, which was a great tournament, one of the best tournaments, I think. Although, and maybe we will get into this a little bit as well. You know, I think a lot of people remember the tournament more for the final than for anything else. And because of the way those last two games played out, I do wonder if some of all that talk, and look, we did it here on the podcast as well, about how the 2023 was like one of the best College World Series ever. I do kind of wonder what history is going to actually remember about it. But anyway, we'll get to that in due time, Peter. I guess as we talk about this, though, we're back from Omaha. You had your first College World Series experience, so let's just start there. What are your takeaways from your first time at the World Series?
It was an absolute blast. Going into it, I was super fired up for it, both given the field and the talent in the field and the potential that eventually ended up, the potential got lived up to of all of these great games and matchups and stars shining. And it was an 80 grade experience all around, from the games to the fans that were there to the people that were there. It was top notch, and I couldn't have asked for a better rookie campaign out there. It was an absolute blast of a couple of weeks, and I think you hit on it best. We had all these great games, really 14 outstanding games, and then while the result, LSU in three, was I think what we each may have predicted on the podcast leading into it, the last couple of games, I don't want to call them duds because you can't really call a national championship game in which a team comes out on top with a title, I guess, a dud, but very out of the ordinary and unexpected. But it was an awesome couple of weeks, and I think it culminated with the two best teams playing against each other and LSU, which had some of the highest expectations of any team in recent memory and the biggest target on their back, and they were able to come out on top.
The way the final played out was a little strange. The first game was kind of like an all-timer. You know, it goes extra innings, and LSU has to win in 11 innings for the second straight game, having beaten Wake Forest in that fashion to get to the finals. And then game two, Florida bounces back and wins, you know, and set, not only do they win in a rout, but they set a record for the number of runs scored in a single game in the College World Series, which is like a remarkable thing to do, not just in that, like, oh, hey, you set a record for this tournament that's been played for 75 years. Like, that's cool. Like that would be a lot. But then when you consider like just the various offensive eras that the sport has gone through, and the fact that they used to play with -5 bats as opposed to -3, let alone like the BBCOR standard versus, you know, not having that standard. And, you know, the fact that Rosenblatt Stadium played much more offensive for much of its history than TD Ameritrade Park, and Florida dropped 24 runs, which was bananas. They win by 20 runs. And like, then the next day, everyone said all the right things about like how, you know, from the LSU perspective, about how like, oh, you know, we're going to come back and we're going to be ready for tomorrow. And, you know, we're going to get some rest because it was a day game. Like they were like kind of looking forward to stealing some extra rest after playing a bunch of night games in a row. Like now you got a few extra hours, and they actually did all of that stuff. That wasn't just kind of empty talk that you sometimes hear after game two. Like it's an emotional thing to have a chance to win the national championship and then lose it. But I guess because it was such a blowout, maybe it was easier for them to get over. And then they come out on Monday, they win 18-4. The game was kind of closer than the final score. They scored 8 runs in the final 3 innings to blow that game out a little bit more, but they didn't trail after the first inning. Florida put up a quick 2, and then LSU responded in the top of the second with 6 runs, knocked out Jack Caglione, and you know, really just changed the entire tenor of the game right there. And Thatcher Hurd settled into the game and gave them 6 quality innings, and the bullpen did the rest of it. And one of the biggest talking points of the day, which was Will Paul Skeen's pitch, became a moot point as they didn't need their ace to take the mound on 3 days rest. So LSU ends up the season in a dog pile in Omaha, which was, you know, to Peter's point, this was one of the most hyped teams in college baseball history, perhaps the most hyped team, the team that had the biggest target on its back all season long. And they eventually got there and did it. And they celebrated, they lifted the trophy. Paul Skeens was named most outstanding player, which interestingly, the second year in a row that the most outstanding player has gone to a pitcher who did not appear in the College World Series finals. I don't know how people generally feel about that. Like, I think I voted for him. I think Peter, you probably voted for him too.
I did.
Yeah. So like, I would guess it was relatively close to unanimous. Like, I don't know. Like, it had never happened in College World Series history. At least maybe it was in the finals, which dates back 20 years now, where a player hadn't appeared in the finals and yet was named MOP. And now it's happened in back-to-back years. It's a little goofy. But anyway, like, Skeens is most outstanding player. The LSU, you know, gets their celebration. And, you know, this really, like, long-awaited you know, build up that had, you know, they really started, like, the drum started being pounded for LSU coming out of the draft last year, I guess. Like, Paul Skeens committed in late July. Maybe that was kind of when it started, as like, oh, this team is, you know, not only is this team going to be good because, you know, Dylan Cruz and Trey Morgan and, you know, Tommy White had transferred in before the draft, but then Ty Floyd, you know, doesn't get picked, Paul Skeens commits, and at that point it's kind of like, well, hello, like, this team is going to be bonkers. And then, you know, as the fall goes on and you get fall ball, like, the drum starts beating louder and louder, and by the time preseason comes, it's like, well, this is the clear-cut number one team in the country, and everything that came with that. And for them to go on and then actually win the national championship, they're just the second team in the 21st century that was preseason number one, that went on to win the national championship. And the other one was 2019 Vanderbilt. And that Vanderbilt team was awesome in retrospect and in the moment, but also throughout much of that season, UCLA was ranked number one. So despite the fact that Vanderbilt came into the season ranked number one, they didn't fly under the radar. They were the SEC champions in kind of a runaway fashion, but they didn't have some of the same attention that this LSU team did, having the number one spot for 12 straight weeks and you know, having some of the the players that they did, you know, the Cruz, the White, the Skeens, that Vanderbilt team wasn't like JJ Bleda was a really good player, but he wasn't Dylan Cruz. And they had a lot of older players, a lot of seniors on that team. So it was just kind of a different vibe. And so this LSU team had to deal with a lot more of those expectations over the course of the season. They dealt with some injuries along the way. Nothing really fazed them. In the end, they are your 2023 national champions. And it's a really cool story to see how all of that came together for them. But it's also an incredible team that they were able to work through everything that they did to get to that night in Omaha, with the fireworks and the trophy and the dog pile.
Yeah. And going back to the final series a little bit with Florida and then also touching on your point with Vanderbilt, it was really, you know, Austin Martin, JJ Bleda, Drake Fellows, guys like that. And again, really good baseball players, really good college players, but it wasn't they didn't have potential. No, I guess Austin Martin and JJ Bleda were each in the conversation for being picked first overall at some point, but they didn't have and nobody had the Cruz, Skeens, Tommy White, kind of that big three. And I think that the hype, again, it started a little bit kind of around this time last year. And then, as you said, it just got louder and louder, the noise surrounding the team with getting Skeens, Thatcher Hurd, getting some luck with guys not getting drafted or not signing, getting a really good freshman class to campus, which I think was one of the more underrated parts of this LSU team. I know in the end that it was mostly veteran based and the guys that came through in Omaha were veterans, but you also get a really good freshman class to campus. We saw Griffin Herring in Omaha have a really good appearance out of the bullpen. Brady Neal at the start of the season before he got banged up proved that he'll probably be, their guy down the road at behind the plate when Malazzo and or Travinsky move on. Jared Jones has some big time raw power. I'd almost give it 70 grade raw power. He has 20 home run upside. Paxton Kling off the charts. I mean, I could go on and on about these guys, and they were set up well, not only for this year, but I think going forward, especially with how Coach Johnson utilizes the transfer portal. And I know that at the time Skeens was a great get, given what he did at the Air Force Academy and, the caliber player he was, but I don't think anyone foresaw the kind of jump he was going to make on the mound to turn himself what he is today. There was so much buzz in the fall around him sitting triple digits and all this stuff about the slider becoming, a double plus offering for him and all of this. And then to see it live on opening day against Western Michigan, it was like, okay, this guy is different than everyone else. And for him to sustain that throughout the year and for everyone, Dylan Cruz, Tommy White, Cade Beloso, Trey Morgan, that whole supporting cast to sustain their production throughout the year was incredibly impressive. And especially when they were able to weather that storm in the later part of the year, when there were a lot of questions around the bullpen and, they don't have the pitching to get through a tournament setting. They don't have the pitching to sustain kind of a grinded out series in Omaha. If they go down one, how are they going to dig out of that? And then in the end, it was the bullpen that ended up really shining between Griffin Herring, Riley Cooper, Thatcher Hurd out of the bullpen at times throwing three innings, Gavin Guidry, another freshman who's going to be really good. It was a very, very impressive season end to end for LSU. And especially living up to all that hype. And then again, just going back to the championship series game one, after the end of game one, I was really excited for what the next one or two games, were going to bring, just given the fact how close it was, how well played the game was. Ty Floyd. I know that Skeens was named most outstanding player in the end. And I was thinking of other candidates who may have gotten some votes or who may have warranted an MLP selection. Ty Floyd obviously is one. 8 innings, 17 strikeouts is second most in CWS history. And he was outstanding for his 8 innings pitched. And I think that, he really improved his draft stock, solidified himself as a day one pick. The fastball was jumping out of his hand. That was his go-to pitch, and being able to pitch with your fastball is such a key. And he was able to do that against a really good Florida team. And then I don't think that they're in the spot that they're in now without Josh Pearson's catch in the 10th inning. And I think that in a College World Series with so many great moments, and even the CWS Finals with so many great moments and big plays, big hits, I think that this one is going to be an underrated one for the rest of time. But to kind of set the stage, Florida had guys on first and second with two outs, with one out, actually, excuse me, in the bottom of the 10th inning after Cade Curlin singled. You had Langford and Caglione coming up for Florida with a chance to walk it off and take a 1-0 lead. And then Wyatt Langford hits an absolute missile off the bat, admittedly, from my angle. I thought it was going to get over his head and be a walk-off. Josh Pearson got a great read on it, made a leaping catch. LSU gets out of the inning. Riley Cooper gets out of the inning. And then the 11th, Cade Beloso leads it off with a home run, and Cooper slams the door in the 11th. So they go up 1-0. And then in game two, I think that you made a great point in talking about the series where I think that losing like this 24-4, and I know that it's the least ideal setting possible to get absolutely curb stomped like that and lose 24-4, have records set against you. But at that point, you kind of, I feel like you just go back into the clubhouse and there's really nothing you can do but just kind of laugh and flush it. Like, baseball's so weird. Stuff like that's going to happen. Florida's a great team. They won 24-4, but again, LSU really after the, gosh, maybe the third or fourth inning, they kind of punted on the game a little bit. And so again, 24 runs is impressive no matter how you do it. But they were gearing up for a game three, it felt like, from the fourth inning on. And after that, you kind of go back and regroup, and it's like, hey, you know what? We're still one win from a national championship. We beat these guys in a really well-played game. The day prior, we've got, you know, we feel really good about Thatcher going. Tomorrow, we'll have Riley Cooper and Gavin Guidry still available. And then if we really need them, we've got the best pitcher in the last 20, 25 years in college baseball in our back pocket. So, I think it was really easy to go in and flush that game and even kind of stop the massive wave of momentum that Florida built. And then even in the start of game three, when Wyatt Langford hit that home run in the first inning, an absolute no doubter, I was like, oh man, you know, here we go again. Florida might just be a runaway train at this point and run away with this thing. But Thatcher heard after that, because Florida started the game with two hits, with the Curlin single and then Langford's tank. And then Thatcher Hurd more than settled in. He threw six straight after the home run. He threw six straight shutout hitless innings, struck out seven guys, only walked two, spun a really good breaking ball as he has all year with spin rates over 3000, fastball up to 95. And then again, you just kind of let the offense go to work. They got to a really, you know, Jack Caglione, it was evident from the start that it was going to be the, can't find the strike zone, trouble commanding Caglione, which has kind of been his MO all year, a tale of two pitchers where he'll either be all over the place or he'll be dialed in and give you six or seven really good ones. And it was unfortunate that it was not the six or seven really good Caglione that afternoon, both for Florida and then also just from watching the game. Him, when he's on, he is a really talented pitcher and one of the most talented arms in the country. But LSU jumped on him, and then they jumped on everyone else thereafter. And, you know, they could kind of let that national championship feeling marinate and really enjoy it and soak it in. So a very impressive showing end to end for the Tigers. And then talking about the Gators a little bit, again, losing in Omaha in game three in that fashion, you know, I can't imagine how gut wrenching that is. And, you know, losing it all in Omaha is brutal, but again, I think that they're really set up for the future. You've got a good core of returning guys with Caglione, Heyman, and Curland there. And you've got Brandon Neely still to turn to out of the bullpen, as well as some other really good supporting cast members. And I'm sure that they'll utilize the portal just as every team does. So, again, I think that Florida is poised for another deep run to Omaha. I mean, it's very realistic. They find themselves in this exact setting again next year, given who they have and who they'll probably be bringing in. So they're probably not one for silver linings right now, but still a really impressive season for Florida, who won 54 games.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And we'll we can get into a little bit about these teams moving forward here a little bit later. But yeah, if you're Florida right now, obviously you're not feeling good that, you know, you just lost the national championship in any way, shape or form. But to get back to this stage, which they hadn't been on since, you know, they hadn't been to Omaha since 2018, hadn't played for a national title since they won it in 2017. You know, I think that has to feel very good, obviously. You know, and this is a team that had a fair amount of expectations coming in, but Florida does every year. I remember I was talking on some radio show somewhere early preseason, I guess. We had them ranked number three, and I was asked, so like, what's, sell me on this team? Like, what's different about 2023 Florida versus 2021 or 2022 when they had started really highly as well and, you know, ended up losing home regionals and weren't, you know, if you just look at the NCAA seeding, NCAA tournament seeding in those years, they were near the back of the hosts. And, you know, I wasn't really sure how to do that. Like, they had a lot of talent this year, just like they did those other years, but they were able to put it all together this year and get back to the stage. And health had something to do with that, but it's not just because they stayed healthy. You know, Wyatt Langford is an incredible player, and Jack Caglione, actually in that game on Sunday in that route, hit his 33rd home run of the season, which, you know, matches the most hit by any player in the 21st century, and is the most hit since the bats changed to the BBCOR standard. You know, so like having players like that emerge in the lineup, obviously is really significant. Getting Spro to come back, getting Waldrop to transfer in, and, you know, the whole thing really came together for Florida, and it ends up one win short. And, you know, they get blown out in the final, and so I think a lot of people are looking at it like, well, LSU was just the better team. Like, they blew Florida out in game three. Like, Florida had their rotation set up, and Skeens didn't even pitch, so LSU's just clearly the better team. And, like, I don't think that's a wrong read, but I will say that, like, you know, Peter's talking about that play that, not just Peter, a lot of people in the ballpark thought that Wyatt Langford had just walked off game one. And if they had done that, they almost certainly, especially seeing how game two played out, and LSU did punt a little bit at the end of that game, but, you know, it was a blowout before they, like, officially punted. And if they walk off game one, Florida's your national champions. And, you know, LSU had Josh Pearson positioned perfectly. Pearson made a great play on the ball, but, like, that's still how close it is. Like, Wyatt Langford hit that ball, I think it was 112 off the bat. And, you know, Josh Pearson is in the right place, makes the play, and the game continues, and Cade Beloso hits the go-ahead home run at the end. And, like, that's how close Florida is. That's not going to make anyone in Gainesville feel any better, I don't think. Like, I just watched an interview today that Kramer Robertson did, and you're asking, why are you talking about Kramer Robertson today? Well, Kramer Robertson was on the 2017 LSU team that got swept by Florida in the finals, and I guess he plays for AAA Memphis right now in the Cardinals system. And I guess they were off on Monday because in this interview, he said that after they played on Sunday, he went home to Baton Rouge, where his mother, Kim Mulkey, as many of you know, is the LSU women's basketball coach. I guess they were just kind of given Monday off. So he goes home, and his mother is on a charter flight from Baton Rouge to Omaha for the championship game. Like, many LSU personnel went up there, and she told her son Kramer, like, you can come, like, we've got a spot for you. And he declined because basically that, like, the weight of losing the national championship had been weighing on him so much for the last 6 years. He felt like he couldn't watch that game with anybody else, couldn't be in that stadium. And so, like, that's, like, they got swept, and it was like a close series, but they still got swept. It wasn't like they lost on some walk-off in three games or whatever. And so that's what losing a national championship can do. And so, like, none of these Florida players are going to feel good about this anytime soon, but they were, like, spectacularly close to a national championship here. And the how well Florida played in Omaha and throughout this season should not be lost.
Yeah, it's funny. I saw that interview too this morning, and I thought it was a really good perspective that he provided, and a good refresher for everyone out there about, you know, how stuff in Omaha and College World Series, especially the finals, you know, that's going to stick with you. And hearing him talk about, you know, how he wasn't even ready to step foot back at Charles Schwab Field after that. And I don't blame him. And, you know, like you said, I'm sure that everyone on the Florida roster is, you know, they'll have different feelings about it, but I'm sure that they will all empathize with him and feel similar to him. And then when Florida wins their next national championship, which that is absolutely a when and not an if, this whole 2023 team, and maybe some members of the 2023 team are on their next national championship team. But regardless, whenever that next national championship comes, there will be a little bit of a sigh of relief from all on the roster. And then looking ahead a little bit to next season for Florida and in their recruiting class, so much hinges on the draft and so many variables that we could spend 3 hours, 4 hours talking about with the draft and signability and all of this. But as it usually does, Florida has an excellent recruiting class. And I think in a positive development, it is very pitching heavy. And if they lose a couple of guys at the top, particularly Steven Echevarria and Liam Peterson, a duo of right-handed pitchers who have been excellent all spring. If they lose guys like that, they're still pretty well equipped in the middle and the back end of their recruiting class with guys that can come in and contribute not only down the road, but right away, like we saw this year with some of their freshman arms. Cade Fisher, especially one of them. And then looking at the rotation, which I think that you have two big holes that you're going to have to fill with Waldrop and Sproat. I think it's great getting an anchor like Jack Caglione back. Continuing to polish him on the mound is going to be key, but I have ample faith in Florida's really great coaching staff that they'll be able to do just that. So I think when they keep refining him and keep refining his delivery, he's going to be a guy that you can kind of view as your rotation anchor. And Cade Fisher seems like someone that you can seamlessly slide in there to pair with Caglione and give you a duo of really good lefties, one more pitchability, another guy more thunderous stuff and velo. And then obviously offensively, Caglione's going to lead the charge again with Cade Kierland, Luke Heyman again. And then I think that one guy who I have circled that I would not be shocked at all to really have a big time junior season, establish himself as a top 5 to 7 round draft pick, and be the guy that sort of comes out of nowhere, given his previous track record of performance in college, is Ty Evans. You look at his stats for this year, and just looking at the stats, nothing's going to jump out at you. You'll probably be like, oh, he had an underwhelming year. He had 239 with 9 home runs and 42 strikeouts to just 9 walks. But coming to the College World Series, he only had 4 home runs on the year. And at Charles Schwab Field, which we've mentioned so many times, is notorious for being an anti-hitter park, very pitcher-friendly, really hard to get the ball up in the air and drive it out. Ty Evans hit 5 home runs, including a 2-home run game in Florida's 24-4 route, to up his season total to 9. And he made the all-tournament team for his performance, which, given the amount of talent in this year's field, is extremely, extremely impressive. And so he's
especially in the outfield. Like,
oh, exactly. Because
like when you start with Laneford and Cruz, there's only one spot left.
Exactly. So he was basically one guy competing with, gosh, however many other outfielders are in there, I guess we'll say 20 to 22 outfielders competing for one spot. And deservedly so, he got named to the all-tournament team. So I came away blown away with Evans and kind of really keeping my eyes on him as we go into the fall and next spring as someone who will be, I think, a key contributor for the Gators. So they're set up well, I think.
The position player group has some holes that they've got to fill, right? Because Josh Rivera is gone, you know, multiple years starting shortstop, moving on. Like, that's always a little scary. BT Raiapel, 2 years starting catcher, moving on. That's a little scary too. Wyatt Langford ended the season basically playing center field every day for the last month, I would say. Like, switch kind of happened for good in the SEC tournament, I guess. So, like, the spine of your team is going to look a little different next year. Does Curlin move to shortstop? Does somebody come in that's more of a glove? You know, we'll have to see. They've got some options at catcher. Luke Heyman can play back there. They brought in a transfer from Coastal Carolina that's a really good pitch framer. You know, but you are losing senior leadership with Riopelle and Rivera. And, you know, so it is, it, no matter how you fill those roles, it's going to look a little different. And one thing that I've become very attuned to after the last 2 years is, you know, it's one thing to fill the production. It's another thing to fill the leadership void. Like, I am a firm believer in what went wrong at Mississippi State in 2022 and what went wrong at Ole Miss in 2023. Like, well, some of it was probably a little bit on the outside of us underestimating the influence of Tanner Allen and Tim Elko and Dylan DeLucia and players of that nature. So I don't want to keep making that same mistake. And like, Rivera and Riopelle and Langford all leaving together does leave a bit of a leadership vacuum. And on the pitching staff, you know, having Sproat, who has been a multi-year member of the rotation, leave, is a little disconcerting as well. Now, that being said, like, Florida's going to have plenty of talent. Like, you outlined a lot of it there. Pierce Coppola could be back from injury next year. That would also be a boost to the rotation. Brandon Neely's going to pitch important innings, whether that's at the back of the game or the start of the game. You know, we'll have to see. But they'll have options on the mound. They've got, you know, Cags and Kurland and Heyman in the lineup. We saw a lot out of those guys. And Ty Evans has been very intriguing at various points during his career for the last 2 years, I would say. And obviously in Omaha, he played really, really, really well. So we'll see where they end up. But like, this is a really talented team moving forward. There's there can be no doubt about that. And, you know, we know what Florida is capable of doing in terms of recruiting. They've already added Colby Shelton through the portal, freshman All-American from Alabama who hit 25 home runs. The Florida native is returning home after one season with the Crimson Tide. So like, that's another bat you can plug into the lineup. You know, they're probably not done in terms of stuff like that. So they're in a really good spot. And, you know, with that staff, Kevin O'Sullivan, Chuck Turalleman, like those guys have done a really good job for multiple years, for Sully for almost 20 years now. So we'll see where they are, but I you have to feel good about that team moving forward.
Yeah. And I think that you're going to have to feel good about Florida, not only next year, but really so long as that staff is in place. I think they do such a great job year in and year out. I know they had a couple of premature exits recently, but coming into the season, their roster is as, you know, loaded as anyone in the country. And then I think, again,
we're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't a search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. That's why I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America. It allows me to do everything on one website. I get quality candidates. I can schedule them. I can interview them. I can screen them. I can send messages to them, all within Indeed. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes,
ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Flipping back to LSU and looking towards the future a bit, they're going to have some pretty big shoes to fill offensively, and I think that they're impossible to fill with the loss of obviously Dylan Cruz and then Cade Beloso, Trey Morgan also departing. At least I think that if they can keep at least one of Milazzo or Travinsky to remain behind the plate, I think that would be a huge win. Referred a little bit to Jared.
Yeah, LSU has a lot of guys who are like very, like they have like the clear cut draft guys like in Skeens and Cruz and Morgan. And then they also have a bunch of guys that's like, well, maybe.
Yeah, there are a lot of guys where they could get, we could be sitting here in August or September, whenever we start to talk about the fall and saying, man, LSU again really lucked out with the draft because they have Travinsky back. Jordan Thompson decided to come back. Braden Joubert is back again. Alex Milazzo is also back. And then you're talking about really replacing, again, 3 to 4 really big pieces, but it becomes a lot more manageable than having to replace 2/3 of your regular lineup. And then I think on the pitching side of things, again, you have an irreplaceable arm that will leave with Skeens. Ty Floyd's also going to be a day one draft pick. But again, what we saw from Thatcher Hurd in Omaha, he's getting back to the 2022 Thatcher Hurd that pitched himself into a kind of being discussed as a top half of the first round selection in 2024. And if they can keep that Thatcher Hurd and keep him developing and kind of get what they got out of him in Omaha, that's going to be huge to have him in the weekend rotation as one of your anchors. And then Gavin Guidry, I think is I was about to say position player, and I know as an arm, he's still going to be a key contributor out of the bullpen, but I know this summer he's going to be on the Cape Cod League, and I don't know how much he's actually going to throw, but I do know that he's going to get a ton of work on the infield, whether it be at second base or shortstop. So he's someone I think to keep an eye on as a position player to maybe emerge next year as a key contributor. Zeb Rudel, another one. Again, you don't see him anywhere on the stats for this year, but he was one of, if not maybe, their best freshman bat this fall for the Tigers. And then obviously, again, with Coach Johnson not only being an ace recruiter and then just the nature of college baseball nowadays, there will be some transfer portal additions. We already saw it with the addition of Michael Braswell from South Carolina, middle infielder. And then another one who I think is going to be a key arm that will take people by surprise just because no one will have heard of him coming into LSU from Xavier is 6'5 left-hander Justin Lohr. This year for the Musketeers, he was outstanding out of the back end of the bullpen. He was absolutely nails. 1.89 ERA with 63 Ks and 57 innings. And once he gets to LSU and has the resources that he'll have and the development and just being around that great staff, I know that, you know, he will turn himself into a monster for them. So whether or not they keep guys like Riley Cooper, Nate Ackenhausen, they have Lohr to lean on. And then Griffin Herring, another freshman, you kind of look towards guys who might be able to make that jump into the rotation. He's one of them. And then, let's not forget, they had a couple guys go down to Tommy John, too. Grant Taylor was, for my money's worth, and I know prospect writer Jeff Ponce's money's worth, too. Grant Taylor was the best arm that we saw in the Cape Cod League last year, and they unfortunately lost him before the season even started. And he's sophomore draft eligible, and it's kind of TBD on what's going to happen there. But if they get him back, that's another big-time guy that they're going to have. And so it's a little bit murky with LSU in terms of who they're going to lose to the draft, who they might get back, but also similar to Florida, a really good recruiting class with, again, I think they're going to lose a few guys up at the top, but they're deep and they're well-equipped to have some key contributors right away. And I think that this new era, the Coach Johnson era of LSU baseball, they're going to be a perennial top five, top 10 team, so long as he's there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to be excited about what he's accomplished in two seasons in Baton Rouge. And, you know, obviously he inherited some really good talent. He'd be the first to tell you that. He is one of the first to tell you that, that part of the reason he took the job is because he knew he'd be able to coach Dylan Cruz for 2 years and Terry Morgan for 2 years. And, you know, he got a national title out of that group, you know, and the fact that, you know, you do have Tommy White coming back next year to anchor the lineup, like that's a really significant thing, even as Cruz and Morgan move on. And I mean, you start looking around, there really aren't that many positions that LSU is you know, unclear at for next year. Second base looks to be relatively open, and like maybe one of the outfield spots depending on how the draft shakes out. So like they're in fine shape. You know, we'll see what the portal or the freshman class brings. But you know, there are going to be really talented players coming to Baton Rouge. The question now becomes what the question has been now for LSU for 2 years is on the mound. And, you know, they're going to lose their top two starters in Skeens and Floyd. And Floyd was underrated all year long because he wasn't Paul Skeens, basically. And it was easier to lump him in with the rest of the pitching staff than to put him with Skeens. But what you saw from him in game one of the finals, striking out 17 batters in 8 innings, that's only one person ever struck out more batters than that in a College World Series start. And Steve Arland is the legend. He struck out 20, but he did it in 15 innings. You know, like Ty Floyd did 17 and 8, and look, the game's changed and all the rest of that. But still, like Ty Floyd stepped up when they needed it. He came through as well as you could have ever asked anybody to do it. And they're now going to have to find a way to replace those two guys. And so the pitching staff, which was maligned all year long, sometimes rightfully, sometimes, you know, scapegoated, but they came through in Omaha. They won this championship series without Paul Skeens. Like, I can't tell you how many people on Twitter or when I would go on radio or wherever, like, would say, like, oh, you know, LSU can't win without Skeens. Like, if they ever lose game one, like in a super regional or in Omaha or wherever, like, they're done, they're toast. And, like, they just won a championship series and Paul Skeens didn't throw a pitch. So, like, that says something about the strength of the pitching staff and how well they were pitching at the end. And also a little bit about the difference between the NCAA tournament and the regular season, how tight you can make your circle in the NCAA tournament versus how much you need the full staff in the regular season. Although, like, they did throw like 11 guys in Omaha or something, and not all of them threw in that 24-4 blowout on Saturday, but a lot of them threw really important innings and a lot of them came through in really big ways, like Floyd, like Ackenhausen, like Cooper. So I will be very interested to see how they go about building this thing out. There's obviously also going to be a new pitching coach as Wes Johnson moves on to Georgia. So a lot is changing on the pitching staff. And to me, that is really the question mark here for next year. I will never doubt a Jay Johnson offense, almost like you don't even need a guy like Tommy White in there, but like, especially not a Jay Johnson offense with like Tommy White and Jared Jones in the middle of the order. But the pitching staff, how it all comes together, and not just how it all comes together this summer, but as the fall goes on and they move into February, what it all looks like, that is going to be the most interesting aspect of this team to me for 2024.
Yeah, without a doubt, because it could go one of two ways. Guys like Ackenhausen and Cooper, I'm sure that they will get opportunities if they really want to sign this summer. That I'm pretty sure of, but whether or not they take that or turn it down will be a huge difference maker for LSU one way or the other. And then circling back to the injuries again, Chase Shores was one of the most talented arms on this ultra talented staff before he went down in the middle of the season with a torn UCL. He's a 6'8 right hander, true freshman. Fastball is up to 101. Really good slider, and then unfortunately his last outing against Tennessee in March. was his last of the season. And so that's a guy that next year, where we're sitting in May around, you know, late April, May, maybe around the SEC tournament, where that's someone who's back for LSU and is a huge boost late in the season. So I do think that it is a bit murky on the pitching side of things, but with you, I know that this offense, just as it did this year, is going to be able to hit LSU to a lot of wins and maybe make up for a little bit of lack of depth on the pitching side, at least in the beginning of the season.
Yeah, and what they have potentially coming there in Shores, and he wasn't the only one that they, like you mentioned, Grant Taylor, we'll see what happens there, but like they did have guys go down that potentially will return at the start of the season or at some point during the season that can also help. And, you know, so that part of this is, you know, that's the biggest question mark moving forward, but like that was also the biggest question mark this season. And, you know, in the end they figured it out. So that's not to say that like, that's the way you want to live every year, or that they'll be able to figure it out to the same level next year. You know, we'll just have to see, but a lot to be excited about if you're an LSU fan, as you start to look forward, not that you need to look forward yet, but as you start to do that over the course of the next month or two, there's plenty to be excited about there. Cade Beloso in their final press conference said that like they would need to build a whole new intimidator for what Jay is going to do at LSU. And, you know, there we'll wait and see on that. But that there is plenty of optimism, plenty of support in that locker room for Jay Johnson, as there very well should be. Like what he got done there in a very short amount of time has been really impressive. And, you know, looking forward, it's not hard to see LSU remaining at the pinnacle of college baseball, you know, in terms of programs for however long he wants to keep it going there in Baton Rouge. And that's lofty to say after 2 years, but like he's done an incredible job, and the way that they've recruited has been really high level, and it's LSU. It's not a program that like we're confused about seeing at the top of college baseball. So, you know, an outstanding season for LSU, and the future continues to be bright, even as Skeens and Cruz and Floyd and Morgan and whoever else move on into pro ball.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just going to be team year to year. They're just going to reload instead of rebuild. Just given the nature of Coach Johnson and who he is, his recruiting ability, being in the SEC, this national championship. And I think that I'm going to try and phrase this the right way. These are all guys that love being LSU Tigers and take great pride in playing for LSU. Guys like Dylan Cruz, Paul Skeens, Cade Beloso, Trey Morgan, all of these guys, for even after their time is done at LSU, which is now, they're going to be very outspoken about LSU and how it's this place to be, and how Coach Johnson and his staff and whoever he brings on and is the new pitching coach, how he's the guy to go to. Both if you want to develop as a player and if you want to win. And I think that there's value in that, both in the national championship and these guys. But then also we could be sitting here in 3 weeks talking about how Dylan Cruz and Paul Skeens went 1-2 in the draft. And that, you know, is really, really potentially remarkable. And I think that that's all of a sell that you're going to need for recruits. And it's like, okay, this is where I want to go if I want to develop, not only into a potential, you know, top 100 overall draft pick, but if I want to be the best at my craft, you know, I'm going to be an LSU Tiger. And I think it's going to remain that way as long as Coach Johnson's there. And I think I agree with Cade Beloso that the way that this is looking down the road, however long that might be, there might need to be an add-on to the Intimidator.
We'll get into more draft stuff within the next 2 weeks, I would imagine. And you can also check out all of Peter and Carlos's and the rest of the draft team's work over at baseballamerica.com. But because this is a hot topic right now, Peter, and because we just named Paul Skeens our college player of the year, this is what everyone wants to know. Pro side, the draft world, like, do you take Cruz? Do you take Skeens? Like, has Skeens passed Dylan Cruz and Wyatt Langford at the top of your personal draft board? Like that was the hot question in Omaha. It's going to be the hot question for the next week. Like, how high can you take Paul Skeens?
I mean, this, it's such a tough hypothetical because not only are you also involving Dylan Cruz in it, but I don't want Wyatt Langford to get lost in the shuffle either, because what I saw in Omaha, both with how he performed in game, you know, on the biggest stage against some of the best talent there is to offer, and then also even in batting practice, which I know it's tough to evaluate off of it, but you can see how the ball flight has, how his swing works, how he's driving the ball, and you could really shuffle it any which way, and there's an argument to be made for any of these three guys in any order to go top three overall. But the highest you can take Skeens is first overall. And I got to admit that, you know, I understand the risk around pitchers. You know, I understand the kind of stigma around taking him first overall, but I mean, when, you know, the nine innings are going to have to come from someone or any collection of arms, and Paul Skeens is the best college pitcher. You know, he's a generational type talent, and I don't know how much, if at all, you can pass on that. And I think that you're looking at one of the surest bets to be a number one starter, to be a front of the line, to be a front of the rotation ace, kind of your next face of the pitching side in Major League Baseball, than Paul Skeens. Seeing him do what he did in Omaha blew me away. And I had really high expectations for him going into Omaha, seeing him pitch for the first time in person. And he, again, blew him out of the water. It was, he plays catch at 97-101. His slider is a power slider in the upper 80s with tons of sweep. That is, for my money's worth, I think a 70, borderline 80 grade pitch. Metrically, it's an 80 grade pitch. His changeup, which used to be his calling card at Air Force, has also been an excellent off-speed offering, which I think is also double plus. And what really blew me away was, and this has really stuck with me, was his at-bat against Brock Wilkin in what was, I think, one of the best college games ever played, in LSU's 2-0 win in 11 innings over Wake Forest. It was against Wilkin in the first inning. He went slider, slider. And you could tell, I mean, just like anybody, Wilkin was uncomfortable in the box. How can you not be against Paul Skeens? He went slider, slider to get to 0-2, and then he dotted a 101 mile an hour fastball in the outside corner for a called strike three. And at that moment I was like, holy cow. And I didn't say holy cow. I was thinking a different word in my mind, but I was like, good Lord, like this guy is, you know, he's an otherworldly talent. And so again, I don't know if he's, in my mind, again, this might just me being scared or soft, I don't know if I could pull the trigger on a pitcher number one, but man, I am really close on my personal board to having him one. I don't know at this point. I really don't know at this point how I can't. And even talent aside, I think what, again, just adds to the aura of him and what makes him so special is his experience at the military academy and how that has contributed to his mental toughness, how he is completely unfazed on the mound, no matter who he's pitching against and where he's pitching against. He couldn't care less, and I mean that in a very positive and in the best way possible, just in the fact that he is not going to blink in the face of adversity. And I think that that is going to serve him well, not only through however long he's in the minor leagues, which I don't foresee to be very long, and then as he makes his way into the big leagues, I think that that will carry him a really long way. So I think that he is right there up at the top of my draft board.
He shouldn't pitch again this year, probably, just given the ramp down, ramp up, and the fact that he's thrown 122 innings already. But like, look, I'm not as plugged into like some of the pro side discussions as I used to be, but like, I don't see why he would play in the minor leagues at all, given the way that the CBA has, you know, been altered in this most recent time. Like, there's a benefit to him breaking camp next year, and like, I don't really know what you're gonna ask him to work on in AAA or AA or whatever. So like, some of that obviously depends on the team that takes him, blah blah blah, like, but like, I don't really know why he needs any time in the minors. which I think adds to his case at number one, because if one of your problems with pitchers at number one is that they get hurt, well, like, you know, he can go be a big leaguer right now and less chance or less time for him to get hurt before he gets to the big leagues. And then, like, and to your point about the mentality, like, it is different, and it's not why we gave him the award. Like, we gave him the award because he struck out more batters in a season than anyone since Jared Weaver. And he had like a 169 ERA, and he was the unquestioned ace for the number one team in the country. And he was far and away the best pitcher in the country this year. Sorry, Rhett Lauder, you were really awesome too, but like, sometimes this happens. You know, like, he just was that guy. And so that's why he was. But part of the reason he is that guy is because the mentality is a little bit different. And some of that is the time he spent at Air Force, some of that's just who he is, whatever. But the moment when LSU wins the national championship and everyone comes running out of the dugout to go dogpile, like, yeah, if you're listening to this podcast, you've seen this by now, but like, he's carrying Alex Milazzo, who broke his leg scoring, you know, a few innings before. And so Milazzo is out there like with this huge cast on his leg, and like, how's he gonna get to the celebration? Well, Paul Skene's just like, gives him a piggyback ride out there. And you can't like put too much on that moment, but the fact that those guys like orchestrated that moment themselves, like, in like, it happened instantly. Like, there's a, you can watch the video of them like right before the final pitch. Like, it looks like Skene turns to him and says, "I got you." And then he goes and he does it. Like, I mean, again, like, I don't want to put too much on that moment, but that is a bit of an illustration of who Paul Skene is. And like, it's a special player. It's also a special person that you're getting. If you, whoever picks Paul Skene, that's what you're getting into your organization.
Yeah. And like you said, it's hard to put stock in a seemingly small moment, but I think that is a perfect metaphor of who he is. It's, you know, others before self. And he is as big a team guy as they come. He could have a really big ego if he wanted to, but he has none. And I think that it is rare in today's game to have someone like that who's that good. And not only with Skene's, I think Dylan Cruz is the same way. You know, he could be really loud and out there if he wanted to, but he's not. And same with Wyatt Langford, honestly. Wyatt Langford is a very quiet, go about your business. Yeah. Very, very go about your business type guy. And I think that these are three players in as soon as, you know, 3 to 5 seasons that could potentially, maybe 4 to 5 seasons, but this could be the next generation of major league stars. And I know that that is a very lofty thing to say, but if not them, then who is kind of my mentality. And I know that there will be guys that pop up. There'll be guys in day two of the draft and day three of the draft that turn themselves into quality major leaguers and quote unquote stars. But I think that these three guys have the potential to, you know, be the next faces of Major League Baseball. And then going back to Skene's in particular with, you know, how long, if at all, he'd be in the minor leagues. I am in the mentality of he will not touch a baseball again this year. I think you hit on it perfectly with ramping up, ramping down, ramping up, the fact he threw so many innings, the fact he threw, you know, so many pitches so frequently. I don't think he's going to touch a baseball. But I think that he's a guy that you assign immediately to Double A. He makes a handful of starts, and I think you call him up, and I think he's up in the major leagues next year by the All-Star break. And I think he's up there for a very long time. So, and these hypotheticals always are so annoying to me with the, like, could like Alabama beat the Jaguars? No, they lose 1,000-0 every time. Could the best college basketball team beat the worst NBA team? No, they lose by 200 points. But do I think Paul Skene could pitch in a lot of major league rotations right now? Maybe every rotation? 1,000%. He is that good. So there has not been an arm like this in a while, maybe ever, with Skene. I think, you know, Strasburg and Gerrit Cole are interesting comps, but there has not been an arm like Paul Skene's in quite some time, if at all. So it will be very fascinating to see how it is handled and how he progresses to the major league. So I'm very much looking forward to it, but that will come in the spring of 2024.
One last Paul Skene's is kind of goofy, kind of amazing story, like, just the get to the mentality bit of this. I think it was in Saturday or Sunday's game, I believe. It might have been Saturday, though. Regardless, he's not doing anything as a starting pitcher who's not participating in the game that day. So there's like a foul ball, and it falls in front of the LSU dugout, and he like runs out to get it, and he eats it. Like, I don't know, he hit a skid or tripped or what, but he ate it. And like, that's just like, he is the best player in the country. He is like their most important pitcher. Like, he does not need to be running around getting foul balls. Like, they have other players that can do that sort of stuff. But that's, I guess it must have been on Saturday night because they were on the first base side. But like, that's just who he is. Like, you know, it's my turn. Like, I'll go run out and I'll get the ball. And I just slipped and fell on my face. But like, I'm just out here doing it like any other player on the team. And like, I think you're right. I think Cruz and Langford would do the similar thing if they were pitchers or whatever the equivalent thing for hitters to do. You know, they would be participating in that same way. And it's a very interesting group that, you know, is at the top of the sport right now, and that, you know, draft officials or evaluators are trying to pick these guys apart. But in terms of makeup and mentality, those three guys all are, you know, definitely plus, and Skeens feels like a clear 80.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
All right, so let's put a bow on the 2023 College World Series. It was fantastic. I do wonder, like I said, like, you know, just the way that people remember these things, like, I do kind of think that the ending matters a little bit. And so, like, is the enduring memory going to be that this was this incredible College World Series that had all of these one-run games, and, like, it had the, like you said, that LSU Wake Forest game in the bracket final was one of the best college baseball games you'll ever see. Like, will people remember that? Will they remember the LSU blowout at the end? I don't know, but I am just glad, Peter, that you and I were able to get to see it up close. And what a fantastic, you know, couple weeks of baseball that got played in Omaha it was.
Yeah, and I'm totally with you. I could not be more thankful and lucky to have been there, to have seen all of this live, because again, LSU in Florida was a fitting final and a really good final at that. But we talked about it in the previous podcast that all eight of these teams were excellent out there in their own right. Even the teams that went 0-2, they played really well, and especially the talent level on all of the teams. And you combine that with the level of play, playing really professional like games, really ironically until the last two games of the whole thing. But it was excellent all around, and as I said earlier, I think it was an 80 of a College World Series. So at least for me, it might be like all downhill from here with just the talent and the level of play throughout. But I know next year and beyond there will be just as many storylines, just as many great players, and another eight teams that we're sitting here talking about that we're really excited about. So could not have asked for a better start, and very excited for all that's to come.
All right, so that'll wrap the 2023 season for us. Thank you all for listening to the Baseball America College podcast throughout the season. We really appreciate it. Everyone that's been subscribed or just hopping in here for the postseason, whatever it may be, if you found us at any time during the season, we are super appreciative. We hope you stick with us as we move into off-season mode, both on the podcast and over at Baseball America and baseballamerica.com. Podcast-wise, we will be back next week at some point to look at the draft and maybe at some other kind of off-season transaction type moves, whether that's coaches or transfer portal, but definitely get ready for the draft, which is approaching very quickly now. And then we'll probably drop it off in July, let Peter focus on the Cape, let me focus on some off time and move in and other things, and then we'll pop back up at some point as we get into August or September, as we can get into recruiting and fall stuff and all of the other wonderful things that you've come to expect in our college baseball coverage throughout the off season. So we'll be back next week. So make sure you're subscribed to the Baseball America podcast on your favorite podcasting app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you find your podcasts. You can find us and hit that subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Peter is at Peter G. Flaherty. And all of the work is over at baseballamerica.com, which I don't know if I'm allowed to say this by now. Hopefully I am. It'll have a new look soon. So if you haven't checked out the website recently, maybe give a look. It's going to get a bit of a refresh here as we move into July. So thank you all again for listening both today and throughout the season. For Peter, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next time on the Baseball America College Podcast.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.